Brooks.
Thank you very much and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just before I start my topic this morning, I'd just like to mention this fact about when I was coming up from Halifax. I won't say the airline, but they managed to lose my little overnight bag. And no, I'm not trying to evoke sympathy. It just creates two problems. One, I was going to talk about some of the disparities between the North and the South today and talk about all the marvelous things we have in transportation and communication. And I never lost a bag or anything in Africa once. And so I have to sort of rethink that one a little bit. Secondly, it creates a problem because my mother, whose name is Sarah Link, who's a Halifax Baha'i, had given me a present to give to somebody here, and I didn't know who it was. I was going to read the name this morning, and it was either for a wedding, a birthday, or somebody having a baby. So if anyone's having any of those this week, congratulations, and one of you will be the lucky winner of a present when I find the bag. So, okay. Anyway. Okay, on to the topic. What I read the list of the seminars that you had yesterday and are going to have again today on healthcare workers and nuclear war, on food distribution and hunger, family violence and human rights and torture. So what I'd like to do today is to touch on a few of these topics, mostly on the nuclear weapons, the militarism and the international health aspects. And perhaps a few suggestions. I don't have too many answers, I'm afraid, but a few suggestions to get us thinking about these topics. We really are at a very critical crossroads in the next 20 years of this sort of planet's survival. We have the pressure of the arms race and that dizzy, unstable spiral, and we have the equal pressure of the population explosion, which I feel is fueled by crushing poverty in developing countries. And both of these things, I think, in the next 15 or 20 years, are going to reach ahead. And there's not a lot of time left. So sort of, it's my pleasure to be here with people who are equally concerned about these topics, and we can get together in the Baha'i tradition of consultation and see what we can do about them. I also believe that the arms race and global poverty, these two issues are quite linked, and sort of a destructive synergistic effect, if you like. And I'd like to address that problem, and especially, as we're all aware, the tremendous amount of resources that are used for arms spending compared to the relatively little amount used for development, and we'll touch on that as well. I don't think the retooling process would be difficult. That is the concept of swords into plowshares. That's a technical thing, and human beings are pretty good at technical things. It's changing the attitudes and the hearts of people. I think that's going to be the really hard thing. And I think that's where we have to direct ourselves. Tolstoy, in his book War and Peace, there's a beautiful little scene, and if you ever saw the movie too, there's Pierre Robespierre is walking down a beautiful road, country road, with a friend, and he's talking. He says to his friend, well, if evil men can get together and conspire to do evil things, then why can't good men get together and conspire to do good things? So hopefully that's what we're here today, to do some good conspiring, some hard work. We'll start off, I think, just a general overview. I'm sure I don't want to over-inundate people with statistics, because they're so hard to comprehend, a lot of these statistics. We'll do a few, but not too many. Just touch on some of the subjects and then talk about, as I said, hopefully some of the solutions. And we'll all go into this in more detail in the seminars this afternoon. Professor Hyatt, who's a doctor of public health at the Harvard School of Public Health, and has been quite active in the Physicians for Social Responsibility against the arms race. He said he's the one who coined the phrase of the arms race being the final epidemic. You've probably heard this term. And he said that nuclear war must be dealt with as an untreatable epidemic, for which there is only one approach, and that is prevention. because the consequences of having such an epidemic would just be devastating, obviously. I'm sure you're aware there's about 50,000 warheads, nuclear warheads now in the world, which is equivalent of 3 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on Earth. It's about 50 times more nuclear power in those bombs that would be required to blow both the Soviet Union and the United States to smithereens. The overkill factor, if you like. And yet we continue to add to our arsenals daily. And it's also very disturbing, the idea that some planners, maybe on both sides of the Atlantic, are considering the idea of a winnable nuclear war, or a limited nuclear war, which I believe is at best a very dangerous fallacy, and at worst the ultimate prescription for the ultimate Holocaust. If we did have an all-out war, the effects, right off the bat, you can be sure that at least 300 million people would be killed outright. And several tens and hundreds of millions would eventually die weeks and months and years later of radiation illness and genetic and cancerous causes. We'd have no medical treatment, despite what people say. Most doctors and nurses and hospitals would be completely wiped out. You can imagine the massive burn injuries that you'd be faced with no hospital supplies. They said if one doctor in your average town had to attend to all the wounded he'd be presented with, he'd have to work for 24 hours a day for something like 40 days just to see everybody once. And you can be sure they wouldn't be getting good burn treatment either. We'd be faced with epidemics and famine. And the concept of nuclear winter, which I'm sure you've heard of, the ecological devastation that would be caused by all the ash that would rise up into the universe, into the atmosphere. And of course, the total social breakdown, which would follow as well. And you stop and you ask yourself, do we really have this right to doom all the future unborn generations over whatever we're having an arms race over? Are we that special at this time in the world, at this time in the man's history, that we could risk it all? I don't think so. It's kind of a chilling note when you talk to the paleontologists and you look at the fossil record, and 98% of all the species that have ever inhabited the Earth are now extinct. And it gives one pause for thought if we're that clever or not. I'd like to touch now a little bit on the problems of health in developing countries. The diseases that these people face in Africa and Asia, Latin America, the malaria, for example, and various worm diseases, we'll go into those in just a second, but they are essentially diseases of poverty. There is some aspect of the fact that the tropical climates do help these diseases, but essentially, they all are diseases of poverty. And if you address the poverty, the diseases, by and large, would disappear. It causes a tremendous, besides the people and children it kills, it causes a tremendous disease burden on people. And you can imagine if your young adults are chronically ill with diseases, they're not going to be very productive. And this would be a major barrier to development in these countries. And hence, as I'll try to hopefully show, a major barrier to peace, both in those countries and in the world as well. One disease is schistosomiasis, which affects 200 million people in developing countries, and it's a worm disease transmitted by snails in fresh water, and it makes people chronically ill and anemic, just really tired and dragged out, and it causes other problems as well, but essentially it just makes you feel terrible for a long time. And it's a paradox that this disease is often introduced into developing countries when you bring in irrigation ditches to help the farms, because the fresh water coming down the irrigation ditches is a great place for the snails to live. And people don't have rubber boots, so they step in the fresh water and they get the disease. And this is something else hopefully I'll address in just a few moments, the idea of developmental aid. It's not always straightforward, and you can rush in with good intentions, but you have to think these things through, what the consequences are. Other diseases are river blindness or onchocerciasis. And that, that as well with trachoma, which is a bacterial infection of the eyes, causes millions and millions of people in developing countries to be blind, and you can imagine the disability that that causes. There's great pictures. I did a degree in tropical medicine in London, England, and in they have a beautiful museum on Euston Road there, and there's a picture of a little boy with a long stick leading several people, maybe 30 or 40, who are blind. And in these villages along the rivers of Western Africa, everybody in the areas, everybody over the age of 40 are blind. It's just a way of life. And the little boys just lead people around. And you can imagine the developmental consequences of that. And trachoma, as I said, the chronic bacterial eye infection is caused simply because there's not enough clean water and enough of it for good hygiene purposes. Often just enough water, when you think of women have to go an hour a day to get the water and an hour back, they're not going to carry a whole bunch extra for bathing and for showering. And usually the water that they do carry is dirty as well. Malaria affects, of the malarious countries in the world, there's probably about 1 billion people live in the malarious countries of the world. And it affects hundreds of millions of people each year, kills about 1 million children in Africa each year. And because of the anemia that it causes again people to be feeling chronically ill and unable to feel productive and to get the most out of the scarce resources that they do have. Our old friend tuberculosis, which we've essentially gotten rid of except for some of the native people in Canada, which I think is something to bear in mind, and in the States, very prominent, 10 million cases a year, and mostly in young adults. Mostly in young adults. Just like we lose a lot of productive young adults in car accidents here, they lose a lot of productive adults with tuberculosis. But it is of hope. I'm sure you're all aware, the WHO in 1980 declared that smallpox had been eradicated from the world, which is a dreadful scourge, and there's no reason why those same techniques with the resources couldn't get rid of all these other diseases too. It's not a question of the technical know-how. It's a question of the will. We have the technical know-how. That's not the problem. Also, the lack of clean and plentiful water, as I mentioned, this causes, we think, about 80% of all the diseases in developing countries. Lack of water or lack of clean water. And that's something that could be relatively easily correctable if there were the will and the resources. Malnutrition, as I'm sure you're aware, a fifth of the people on this planet, between 500 and 1 billion, go hungry and are malnourished. And in children, this is a particular problem because malnourished children are more susceptible to disease. And if you have more diseases, you become more malnourished, and so on and so on. And down you go into that dizzy spiral. Imagine a place in the world where before age one, 25 of every 100 children died before the age of one. Or imagine a place in the world where 37 of every 100 children died before the age of five. Do you know that situation was present in Halifax, Nova Scotia in 1871? And that's equivalent to the worst records you'll find anywhere on the planet Earth today in Afghanistan and Ethiopia and Mali. That was Halifax just 100 years ago. And now Halifax has the lowest maternal and newborn death rate in all of North America. What a tremendous jump. What happened there? I'm interested in pediatrics and in child health in developing countries, and you've probably heard this figure put out by the UNICEF books that come out every year on the state of the children's health, world children's health. 40,000 children under the age of five die every day. 40,000. 15 million a year, which is equivalent to the whole under five population of the United States or that of Europe being wiped out every year. It's incredible. how does one come to terms with these statistics? These children, a third of them, 5 million will die of diarrhea. 5 million will die of vaccine-preventable diseases such as measles and whooping cough and TB. And an equal number will be maimed as well with polio, with mental retardation from malnutrition. That's the equivalent, too, I suppose, if you want to use the statistics of a Hiroshima going off every 3 days. But we don't hear about it on the news. Churchill once said, if a human being dies, it's a tragedy. But if 100,000 people die, it's statistics. You've heard that, I'm sure. When I was in the refugee camp, when I first got there in the fall of 85, we had a small grass hospital, and we had a clinic, and we had several feeding centers. And we were losing about 3 to 5 children in our little 25-bed hospital every day. And just to try, so you can imagine what 40,000 children are like, you just have to have one child die in your arms or see what the parents do. The parents respond just the way that you or I would respond if it were our child. There's grief and there's tears. And if you can magnify that on a scale of 40,000 every day, you can imagine the grief that goes on. And the senselessness of it all as well. It's interesting, a phenomena recently in the Western countries is that older people often end their lives in hospitals and often in intensive care units. And it's not uncommon for someone in a terminal, untreatable illness to die in an intensive care unit after 3 weeks of therapy, which may cost about $50,000. And for $50,000, you could buy enough rehydration solution to save the lives of 100,000 children. 100,000 children. So you just see some of the disparities that are going on. And how does one come to terms with these disparities? Well, they estimate that military spending right now in the world is approaching $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion. Most of that is by the United States and the Soviet Union. And two-thirds of the arms trading in the world is by developing countries buying the arms trade weapons. When you compare the $1 trillion figure to the fact the official aid spending in the world is only about $20 billion. So in other words, for every dollar that's spent on official development aid by the West, or the North, or the South, if you like, $50 is spent on arms. 50-to-1 ratio. Just shows you where our priorities are going. Let's look at the fact I think in the Bible and Isaiah they talk about there's the phrase about beating your swords into plowshares. Let's just see what we could do if we took some of that military spending. For 5 hours of military spending, 5 hours, you could provide clean water for everybody on the earth. 5 hours. Remember, that accounts for 80% of the diseases. You could immunize 100 million children for 5 hours, military spending. For 12-hour spending, which would be the equivalent of about $1 billion, or the equivalent of the purchase of a nuclear submarine, you could eradicate malaria from the face of the earth, just like we did with smallpox. Or you could teach 160 million children for 1 year, for one nuclear submarine. A modern jet fighter, I'm told, will buy you supplies for 1 year for 40,000 village pharmacies. And how many jet fighters do we lose every day? So you can see militarism in the spending kills millions of children every year indirectly by the money that it robs from social and health and development spending. And also, if we look at Lebanon and Central America and Afghanistan, I'm sure it kills children directly as well. And one could contemplate the effects of war on children. So we have a choice here.
We have a choice to continue applying these massive resources to the arms race